And I'd like to introduce our speaker, Jamie from Cyprus.
I have an extra water. I need a stool step, too, huh? Can you see? Is there one? Oh, for gosh sakes. You guys. No, that's all right. I'm not going to stand on it. Please. I'd really be embarrassed. Hi, everyone. My name is Jamie. I'm a very grateful member of the Worldwide Fellowship of Al-Anon and Alateen. And thank you so much for having me here. I'm overwhelmed, I have to tell you. I've never seen anything like this, except at a convention. And so I've been worried like I was going to speak at a convention because I heard how big this meeting was. And it was like, oh my God. This morning I woke up and I thought, oh my God, today's the day. This is it. So I hope God shows up. I do. I have to tell you that I come from Orange County. I live in Cyprus. And we have men's stag meeting in Orange County, a couple of them, and I don't even think their birthday meeting once a year is this big. So I think you guys, you just need a big round of applause for yourself. It's amazing. Seriously, I want to thank you for asking me to come. You know, I'm not a speaker. I'm not a circuit speaker. I have to tell you, so prepare yourself. I don't have a pitch. I have my own story, and I take these notes up here because not that I read from them, but because it's like my security blanket. Like sometimes I lose my memory, you know. And before I forget, I want to thank David for asking me to come and speak. Where are you, David? There you are, David. I said to him tonight, David, he said I was at his first meeting, his first Al-Anon meeting 16 years ago, because he came to my home meeting, and it's still my home meeting. It's the Monday night Cerritos, New Way of Life. We meet every Monday night at 7:30. We have Alateen, and we have preteen, and we get about 75, 80 people. So if you're ever in Cerritos on a Monday night at 7:30, come and see us. David was there for a long time, and David was 16 years younger, and so was I. So was I. I want to thank Annie and Jean for coming up here with me. Annie said as we were driving up in the rain, now I call this going to Annie Lennox, and so I don't know about that, but I do want to say that either one of them could come up here and give my pitch for me because they come with me a lot. And so if I mess up or if I'm stuck somewhere, kind of, okay, raise your hand and tell me. Okay, so anyway, I want to tell you that I've got 34 years in Al-Anon. December 30th, I celebrated 34 years. That means I was 10 years old when I got here, and my family thanks me for sticking around. My family thanks you for helping me stick around, and the world is a better place because I'm in Al-Anon 34 years. Trust me, believe me, it's a better place. When I got here, I like to remember that I heard this at a meeting. Anything that I share, I've heard at meetings for the most part. Not much of it is, you know, from me, but I got here, I was rigid, responsible, and right. And I was also his mother and his martyr. Yeah. I used to hear that in meetings. I was his M&M. So I don't know if you're anybody's M&M, but I certainly was. I come from this small town in northeastern Ohio. It's not so small. It's really, everybody knows about it. It's Youngstown, Ohio. Anybody know about Youngstown, Ohio? Oh, I love it. You know what I like to say? I like to tell you that I'm an Ohio girl, but a California woman. So, yeah, that's what I learned here. And I come from this 100%, I know we're not supposed to say, but 100% Italian, like you wouldn't know. I use my hands all the time. 100% Italian family. I mean, nobody else was anything else. And we used to say, my dad used to tell me, there's only two kinds of people in the world, Italians and people who wish they were. And I don't know if that's an old saying, but I kind of thought it was cute. And so anyway, I was raised with my grandparents. My grandpa died the night before their 69th wedding anniversary. And imagine that. And so grandma, she was 16 when he married her, and she never learned to read or write. And those are really going back there, you know, came to Ellis Island and never served my grandfather's store-bought bread. Served him homemade bread, Italian bread, every single day for 69 years. And so that's the kind of women that I came from. It was, you showed your love by taking care of the guys, you know, by cooking and cleaning. And I still do that. That's still a big part of who I am, and it's still a part of showing you that I love you by cooking, baking, all that stuff. I bake 1,000 cookies at Christmas time and give them away. And anyway, so that's the kind of women that I come from. And my dad was just this Joe lunch bucket guy, no alcoholism on his side of the family at all. And my dad I used to say that when I was early in program, that my dad only had one fault, and it's that he thought my mother didn't have any. And because my mother was, oh my God, my mother was raised in the disease of alcoholism, and so there was nothing but the disease of alcoholism in our home growing up. But they weren't drinkers. I mean, they drank socially, but my mother had all this ism, you know, and so it was brought into the family, and my dad thought she didn't have any. But later on, as my mom got older and was elderly and my dad died, she started drinking very, very, very heavily. And I believe she became an alcoholic. So I'm also the daughter of an alcoholic, the wife of an alcoholic, the ex-wife, not the wife, the ex-wife, the mother, the granddaughter. My grandfather died without any legs. He had both legs amputated because of the disease of alcoholism. So I come from a long line of alcoholics. Okay, so I got here. My life was in shambles. I was having an affair with my husband's best friend. Now, 34 years ago, they weren't sharing about that in meetings, let me tell you. Nobody was talking about that, and I creeped into the rooms and hoped that I never had to share it. And it's been, you know, it's been a big freedom for me to be able to say that, because I was doing that. I was, the kids were like a noose around my neck. I didn't want to be their mother. My husband, the disease of alcoholism had robbed me of my self-worth and my self-esteem. I had it all together on the outside. I looked like I had it all together, and on the inside, I was dying inside. You know, I had lost all hope, and I really thought that there was no way out. And I got to these rooms, though, and I thought, you know, what am I doing here? I don't belong here. Can you imagine that? I thought I didn't belong. And there weren't a lot of men in the rooms, okay? I'm going to tell you that. There were not a lot of men in the rooms 34 years ago. Is there anybody here that has that much time in the room? No, see? None of you guys were here, see? So there weren't a lot of men in the rooms. But there was one guy, and if you're new, I'm going to tell you this story. There was one guy that was in Orange County. His name was Bert. He's dead now. I don't know if anybody remembers Bert, but Bert used to wear a white Panama hat. And he started the men's meeting in Costa Mesa, and now it's in Garden Grove. It's the Orange County men's meeting that everybody knows about, like they know about yours. And Bert started that meeting, and he was like the guru in Orange County. And so we go out to coffee with him, and he used to say, living with an alcoholic is too much for most of us. That's what our literature says. Living with an alcoholic is too much for most of us. And so I always remember that. So if you're new, you know, our literature tells us that living with an alcoholic is too much, and it doesn't say drunk and it doesn't say sober. It just says living with an alcoholic, okay? So Bert used to tell this story. We were at the coffee one night, and he said, you're going to serve the alcoholic breakfast, and maybe some of you guys, old-timers, have heard this story. You're going to serve the alcoholic breakfast, and you scramble the eggs, and you put the eggs in front of the alcoholic, and the alcoholic says, I didn't want scrambled eggs. I wanted fried eggs. Okay, so the next day, you fry the eggs, and you put the eggs in front of the alcoholic. And he says, I didn't want fried eggs, I wanted scrambled eggs. Okay, so the next day, you scramble one egg and you fry one egg. And the alcoholic says, you scrambled the wrong egg. Bert told that, and so you know, that's the kind of recovery that I had early on. And I'm going to tell you something. Somebody talked about the big book. I wander around. I'm not somebody that stays on that path and gives you this story, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. I try to, but I serve as your delegate to the World Service Conference. And I want to tell you a little bit about that later. But serving as your delegate has been just such an honor for me. And that's what I like to remember that I'm doing, is that I'm serving. And I've lost my train of thought. I don't know where I was going with that. But, oh well, hopefully it's going to come back. Oh my God, where was I going with that? Who knows? See, the notes don't even help, folks, okay? God, where was I going with that? I can't remember. I guess it's not important. What? Oh, the big book. That's right. Okay. So, thank you. So, you know, we have all this conference-approved literature, and somebody said something about the big book earlier, and somebody said something at a meeting Tuesday night. I was at a step study, and somebody said something about, well, they used the big book early on, and blah, blah, blah. So I'm going to tell you a little history about why they used the big book. It's because they didn't have anything else. That's why they used the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, because they used the Bible, because they didn't have anything else. They didn't have any Al-Anon literature back in the day. And the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous was on the Al-Anon literature form until the 50s. Because you could order the big book for your Al-Anon meeting up until like 1957. So we didn't have any conference-approved literature. And now we have conference-approved literature. So I just wanted to tell you a little bit of history about why the big book gets kind of, you know, but we use conference-approved literature, right? Okay. So anyway, we'll go back to Al-Anon stories. So anyway, I get to Al-Anon, and now before I got to Al-Anon, I was my current husband. You're going to have to keep track of my husbands now, okay? It might be a little hard, but you're going to have to keep track of them. So the current husband was in Afghanistan, and he was working for a defense contractor back in 1979 or whatever that was. They were having another conflict with the Taliban, but I think they called him something different then. But anyway, so he was in Afghanistan, and I was, you know, with his best friend. And the best friend owned a catering truck, a hot truck, okay? And those big hot trucks that kind of ramble down the road. And I'm the kind of Al-Anon that I will go to any lengths. And I want to prove to you how much I love you. And so I worked on the catering truck. And I had my mother working on the catering truck with me. So the two of us, she was the cook, and I handed the food out the window. And not only did we hand food out the window, but we also handed drugs out the window, okay? This was a catering truck driver that was doing that. Now, I'm really glad that the statute of limitations has, okay? And there's no police or narcs in the room. I think that, okay. But anyway, he was doing that, and I was handing it out the window, thinking that it was fine. The other thing that I used to do before I got to Al-Anon was that I had three kids. I still do, by the way. But I would say I had. They were little then. And the oldest was about 9 or 10, something like that. The youngest was less than a year old. And he lived in Southgate, and I lived in Cyprus. And I would drive at night to Southgate from Cyprus after the kids got to bed. No babysitter, you know. Everybody was in bed asleep. Check everybody, go to Southgate, and get home in the wee hours of the morning, 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, thinking that was all okay. Thinking that, you know, and you know what? I called that love. I don't know about anybody else in the room. I did a whole lot of things that I'm not proud of, but I tell you that because I'm hoping that if there's somebody in the room, you know, they call that child neglect, they call that child abuse, they call that child endangerment today. Well, they weren't talking about that stuff back then. And I was driving to Southgate most nights just to you know, because God forbid he would think about driving to Cyprus. But anyway, so, you know, I got to Al-Anon, and I got a sponsor right away, and, you know, she had me start working the steps. When I got to the amend steps with my kids, I had to stop and think about that oldest child and the amends that I owed her. That I had her become the co-adult in the house, you know. I shared inappropriate things with her because that's what we do in the disease of alcoholism, you know. We take those kids and we tell them things that we shouldn't be telling them, and we put responsibilities on them that they should be kids. So that daughter was always an old soul. And she was also an overachiever, because today she's, you know, she's got a psych degree, and she's got a, she's licensed to be a hairdresser, and she's a licensed real estate, whatever, and she married a guy 20 years older than her. And, you know, it's because she was always an old soul. And my part in that was that I helped create that, you know. So if you're sitting out there and, you know, those are the kind of things that might be still happening in your home, that's all part and parcel of the disease of alcoholism. But we have recovery today. And that recovery challenges us to do it different and to share with sponsors and with friends. We used to call our friends our CB buddies because we commiserated with them. That's what my sponsor called them, the CB buddies, your commiserating buddies. So my first ex-husband and I finally got divorced, and I got to marry the best friend. Now, I got to tell you about this scenario here. Now, when the first husband moved out, he moved in with the best friend, okay? And then I married the best friend, okay? And then the best friend and I got married, and then when we split up, he moved back in with my first husband. It was insanity. They call that insanity. I called it paranoia, because I was convinced they were talking about me. Okay? I was convinced. And I used to say to my kids, what are they saying about me? And they'd say, Mom, you're paranoid. I'd say, yeah, I know. So, okay, so then... Then we have this house situation. I have to tell you about that, my house situation. So I still live in the same house, you guys. I've managed to hang on to it. So I bought it with the first husband, and then I had to buy it off him. And then I had to buy it off the second husband. Okay? I don't know how I hung on to it. Now I'm married for the third time. Okay, now that's the last time, guys. So don't be thinking anybody has a chance. Okay? So when I got married to the third husband, I said, look, okay, I have bought this house way too many times. Okay? And we're going to have this upfront conversation here. It's my house, okay? So... anyway, I got married, and I want to say to some of these women here that are single, now, I don't know about you single gals out there. Are there many single gals out here? I don't know about you, but I like to tell you that I dated a lot of non-conference approved men. I did. And I was in Al-Anon, too, okay? I like to date the guys that I had to put the seatbelt on. Okay, and they were usually alcoholic, and some were sober, some weren't. Some of the sober ones were a little bit crazier than some of the alcoholic ones. I don't know, but anyway, remember the one, Annie? Oh my God, I won't even tell that story. Oh my God. Anyway, I got to marry this guy, and my sponsor told me, when you know, watch what you pray for. So watch what you pray for, you guys, because I had to have it. I had to. There was no letting go. There was no let go and let God. There was, I am going to do whatever it is I'm going to do to get him to marry me. And, you know, and we got married. And we got married by the AA judge in the AA sponsor's house, with the Al-Anon sponsor and all the Al-Anons and AAs, and we were were going to live happily ever after. And oh my God, what a disaster it was. What a disaster. His kids, my kids, it was a disaster. We weren't even married 2 years. And when he left, I have to tell you, he put my self-worth and my self-esteem in his back pocket and he walked out the door. And I was a mess. I was just a mess because I really, really, really did love him. And it took me a long time to recover from that. And I threw myself into service. Service was that spiritual connection for me. they talk about the spiritual principles in these rooms, and that's what service did for me. I went to the SoCal convention in Bakersfield, and my sponsor today is Kay Brewster. And Kay said to me, you go back to your meetings and you put away chairs and clean ashtrays. That's when we cleaned ashtrays. We were smoking in rooms then. And she said, you go back and you be a member among members. And that's what I did. And it was one of the toughest things that I ever had to go through. And when I woke up from that, I realized that this second child that I had, this middle child, was in the throes of using and abusing and drinking, and she was 15 years old, and I couldn't believe it. You know, I was in such denial. I had, I don't know, 7 years in Al-Anon or something, and in 7 years, I don't know about anybody else, I thought I knew it all. I had all the answers, and my neighbor called and said, you know, I think you ought to kind of take a look at what your daughter's doing. She's not going to school, and sure enough, she wasn't. And so long story short, you know, I threw her into a rehab, and you guys know the story. You know, she met Mr. Wonderful in the rehab, and, you know, she ended up coming out of the rehab at 16 years old, and she knew it all, and she didn't want to stay sober, and she didn't want to go to school, and she didn't want to follow any of my rules. And what I learned from that is that what my sponsor said was, when she was packing her bags, she wasn't even bags, they were in a laundry basket. She was packing her clothes in a laundry basket, and I was thinking of my grandma. And I was thinking, oh my God, this is not where I come from. I mean, what would my grandmother think? My 16-year-old daughter is packing her bags, she's putting her clothes in a laundry basket, and she's leaving. And, you know, my sponsor said, you know what? You're not throwing her out. She's making a choice not to follow your rules. And I had to remember that, you know. And so the story goes on and on and on with her. And, you know, you've all been through it if you're parents. I don't have to tell you that story because you're living it and I lived it. And I'm grateful to say that, you know, it's behind me. But I want to tell you what I learned from that. I learned a couple of things. One of the things I had to learn was to be teachable. I had to remain humble enough to be teachable because with her, you know, I got to that hospital program and that rehab, and I was going to teach all the parents because I had Al-Anon, and they were all new, you know. And the other thing I learned was about letting go of the dreams. You know, I think it's easier to let go of the kid than to let go of the dreams that we have for them. Because my dream for her was that she was going to go on, she was going to get a scholarship because she was a softball player and, you know, the leadoff batter and her freshman year for the varsity and on and on and on. And, you know, I had to let go of that dream for her. And the other thing I learned is that I have to know the difference with my adult kids, whether they're asking me to be used or to be useful. And I learned that, I heard that in an Al-Anon meeting, somebody sharing about, a parent sharing about, am I being used or am I being useful? And I pass that on to you because boy, oh boy, I still have to ask myself that question sometimes when she calls me. Now, the upside of all of that is that she's 40 years old today, imagine that, and I'm only 41. And, and she's a registered nurse today, you know? That didn't happen until she was 37. She had a long path to go, and she had some stumbling blocks along the way, and you know, all of that. But her life is manageable today. And, you know, my stomach doesn't always churn when the phone rings and I pick up the phone and it's her. She lives in Sacramento, and, you know, she's not a caller, but when she calls, it's usually because she needs something. Sometimes it isn't. Sometimes I get surprised. But I'm current with her today. Our relationship is current today. And that's what recovery has given me today. It's given me a relationship with my kids and with the women and the people and my husband in my life that's beyond my wildest dreams. It really, really is. And my son, I want to tell you that I have this son who is just a joy in my life and always has been. And I'm not turning the page because I'm reading it. But anyway, my son has all these degrees now. He's a principal, and he lives in Atlanta, and he's got many, many, many degrees. And he was really the byproduct of my recovery. And I'm not sure if it was because, you know, I was told in this program that, you know, he's not going to get it from osmosis. And he wouldn't go to Alateen. Now, my daughters went to Alateen. They all fell in love in Alateen. But my son wouldn't go to Alateen. And I told him that he had to do something for his spirituality. And so he did. You know, he went to a private high school. And, you know, he did something there for his spirituality. But the program gave me the guidelines that I needed. You know, the kind of the text that I needed. But whenever I needed anything, I came to these rooms and I'd ask the men in my Al-Anon meetings. You know, I'd go to the men and I'd say, what do I do? What do I do? He's doing this or he's doing that, you know. And so I want to thank all of you for giving me all of that inspiration that I needed in raising a son. Because I didn't know how to respect men when I got here. I was a man's mother. I was his martyr. And all I knew how to do was to be, you know, degraded. And I learned how to respect a man here. And part of it was by respecting the Al-Anon men that became my friends. And the other part was by respecting my son. And when my son graduated high school, he said to me, Mom, I want to take you to breakfast. And I said, okay. And he said, because I want to thank you for what you did, for how you raised me. He said, you did two things right. He said, you were always consistent and there were always consequences. And I learned that here. I didn't learn that anywhere else. There were never consequences in my house when I was growing up, and it was never consistent. My mother said no when she meant yes. She said yes when she meant no. You know, there was never any kind of consistency there. It was crazy most of the time. And, you know, the other thing is that the disease of alcoholism, I thought that he had escaped it. Because his dad and I were divorced, you know, the second husband was out of the house, and for many, many years I was single. I mean, I was single for, 20 years, couldn't have been, but I don't know, something like that. I just got married in 2010, and the alcoholic and I divorced in about 1985 or 86, so I was single a long time. And I thought that my son had escaped all of that, and because he wasn't being raised in, you know, an alcoholic home where there was somebody that wasn't sober. And, you know, he was about 21 years old, and he was sitting watching TV with me and his dad. And I have a fairly good relationship with his dad. His dad's not sober today. His dad lives in Sacramento with my two daughters. And I have a ton of compassion for this guy. I mean, I met him when I was 14. I got married when I was 18. I mean, I've known him all my life. It's like he's been my... Is that my buzzer?
Nope.
Oh, okay. It's like I've known him all my life. And so his dad and I were babysitting one night for one of our grandkids. And my son looked at us and said, Mom, Dad, this is the first time I've ever watched TV with the two of you. He said, in all my life, I've never watched TV with my mom and dad. Now imagine how insignificant that is. But imagine how significant that is for a kid in an alcoholic home that hasn't had that, that's missed having that. And it really struck me that what the disease of alcoholism, how far it permeates in somebody's life, you know? And it really said something to me about... you know, about the disease of alcoholism. My son will also tell you, and he tells me to tell you two things. First of all, that his mother has no filter, especially when I talk to him or anybody else. And the other thing he'll tell you is that he'll say, Mom, if you go out and talk, you tell him two things, that your mother, that your less than 5 feet tall, that you can scream like a 6-footer, but you love like an 8-footer. So before I've got a little bit of time, I want to tell you a little bit about serving as your delegate, because that's really important for me. And so there's a lot of people in the room that might not know what that is, and I want to just explain a little bit about what a delegate is, because I'm here serving as your delegate. And just like your meeting has a group rep, and I met him tonight, and I can't remember where he's at or what his name is, but your meeting has a group rep, and your group rep reports to a district, which is District 24, and then that district reports to an area, and then your area elects a delegate, and that delegate goes to the World Service Conference, and that delegate is your voice and your vote at the World Service Conference in Virginia Beach, just like Willie was the delegate and panel, what panel?
37.
Okay, so he was panel 37, and I'm panel 52. So you can see how many years have gone by since Willie and I, since he was a delegate. So so we have this area that's called California South, and every state sends a delegate to the World Service Conference, except six states. Six states send two delegates, and those states are New York, Florida, Texas, Illinois, Minnesota, and California. So California has two delegates, a northern delegate and a southern delegate. And our area starts at about Arroyo Grande, and it comes down to the Mexican border and over to the desert and to the Pacific Ocean. So we have a huge area, and we have about 1,250 meetings in Southern California. 100 of those are Alateen meetings, and about 330 of those are Spanish-speaking meetings. So we have the largest Spanish-speaking population in the United States. Now, total in the United States and Canada, there's about 15,000 meetings. So you can see how big we are if we have 1,250. And what I want to tell you about that is that I want you to think about a state like West Virginia who has 55 meetings, or Utah that has about 53 meetings, and Southern California has 1,250. So that's a lot of meetings, okay? But my voice and my vote isn't any more important than that voice and vote for Utah or for West Virginia. We all have one vote. Just like at the assembly, each group rep only has one vote. I like to tell you those kind of things because that's part of my service. That's part of my being of service to you. That's part of me letting you know, what Al-Anon's all about, because we're a worldwide fellowship. Because there's delegates there from all over Canada and Bermuda and Puerto Rico. And so we all meet and we have this World Service Conference. And that's how you get your service manual. Because in the service manual, the new service manual's out, there's a whole new chapter on public outreach. It was called public information. It's now called public outreach. And I was part of that last year at our World Service Conference. We changed the whole public outreach. So you have to get your new service manuals to see that so that you know what we changed. So, okay, let me get back to, see, I jumped around and told you that, but I can't help it. I'm sponsored, I told you that. And my first service was, I followed direction, and that was to get in the car. You know, I was told get in the car, and I got in the car. I didn't know where we were going, what we were doing, whether we were going to a meeting or whether we were going to a planning meeting or where we were going, but I got in the car. And I sponsor a lot of women today. And we meet once a month. All of the gals that I sponsor, we meet once a month. We have a step study. And so I'm very active in my recovery. I'm active in the World Service Conference. And, you know, I have to remember today that, oh, I have to tell you about my husband. My gosh, I forgot. See, I forget. Forgot about him. Forgot to tell you how I met him. And I got a little bit of time to tell you. So I met this guy at work. I met him in about 1999. And we married in 2010. We had to make sure that it was going to last. He had never been married. And he didn't have any children. Now, how about that? I mean, it's like 55 years old and you've never been married and you don't have any children. What's wrong with him? And don't think I didn't look for what was wrong with him. those Al-Anon eyes were on, the radar was up, and nice guy, just a really nice guy. You know, it's so simple and so easy with this man, and I'm so used to being in relationships where I have to work at it, and, you know, you come home, and you don't want to go home because, oh my God, there's so much heaviness there, and this guy is just simple and easy and fun, and, you know, we dated for about a year, and my mom and dad had died. My mom had died before I met him, and so had my dad. And my mom and I had a tumultuous relationship, but thanks to this program, I was able to work my steps and you know, make my amends before she died. In fact, long before she died, and be a daughter in recovery to my mother. And my mother, of course, never found recovery, but I was able to be a daughter in recovery for my mother and to be of service to her. And so I wanted to go to the cemetery, and I asked him if he'd like to go to the cemetery with me. And I hadn't been there in a while, and the headstone was, you know, all, well, it's not like a headstone, it's like in the ground, right? And so there's all this grass growing over it, and it's a mess. And so we're there, and I'm kind of trying to pull the grass out and dig everything and make it look halfway decent. And he goes back to his car, and he comes back with a bucket, and he's got all these tools that's needed to clean that gravestone. And I, you know what, it just struck me as, what a neat thing to do. You know, for a guy to even think about that, how did he know that that tombstone or that headstone, whatever it is, was going to need this? He even brought baby oil, you know, to kind of put on the headstone, and it was like, I realized at that moment, it was for the first time in my life, I think I realized that I didn't have to have a seatbelt on, you know? And it was nice. And he was good to me. And he still is, you know? We got married in 2010. We're both retired. And I thought that was going to be an adjustment. I thought, oh my God, I retired first. And then he said he was going to retire. And it was like, no. It wasn't my plan, you know. We can't both be home together. And the first, I like to tell you that the first day that he was a Friday, and it was his first day that he had been retired, and he sat down at the table and he said, "Woman, I want lunch." I said, "I married you for better or worse, but not for lunch." So we have this great relationship, and I never have to cook him. I don't even worry about him. I mean, it's just a simple relationship, and I'm really, really grateful for that. And I sometimes forget that I need to be grateful for that. You know, I got really upset with him last night, and I was sharing at my Monday night meeting. I took his mother somewhere on Sunday. Last Sunday, I took her to a piano concert, last thing I wanted to do, but she's 90 and that's what she wanted to do. So I took her to this piano concert, and she's got this walker, you know, okay, and I'm thinking, oh my God, first you start with strollers and you end with walkers. And so I take her to this, and I get home, and he's got all the dinner ready, you know, he's got everything ready on the look at it and say, isn't that nice? Thank you so much. You're just such a sweet man. I said, where are the napkins? Where are the napkins? You didn't put any napkins. Can you imagine that? 34 years in Al-Anon? Upside the head. And it's like, what the heck? You know, but I caught myself right away. I mean, it was instantaneously. And it was like, you know, here's what I say about the Al-Anon program. There needs to be a recording in our houses as we walk around talking to the members of our family. You know, am I working my program if there was a mouse in the corner and it was you and you were listening to everything I said? Or how about in my car, you know, when I'm driving on the freeway and I'm getting upset with somebody? I think to myself, now that wasn't very spiritual, Jamie, okay? So anyway, I am really, really, really grateful for what I've been given in these rooms. And if you're new, And I know there's some newcomers in this room. What they told me was go to at least 6 meetings, and if it doesn't work, we'll refund your misery. Walk out the door and we'll refund your misery, right? I have to remember that, you know, God looks at my heart and not my resume. And I have to remember that too. And the other thing that I want to give you, you know, I haven't talked much about my higher power, but I have to tell you that the higher power is on a daily basis. I mean, there isn't a day go by that I wake up in the morning. Sometimes my prayer is please, and I wake and I go to bed at night, and sometimes my prayer is thank you. You know, sometimes it's simple, sometimes it isn't. But I have to tell you that I have to see God in lots of different places for me. I have to see sometimes God working in my life. And sometimes I ask God about that. Sometimes I say, you know what, God? I need to see you work in my life. I need to see that. And I got to tell you a story about what happened to me on an airplane recently. I do, I'm really active in the church of my origin. And if I'm 100% Italian, you can only imagine what that church probably is. And so I'm very active in that church also. There isn't anything I join that I don't get active in, okay? And so I do this funeral thing at my church. And I knew a lady that was in her 80s, and she was dying. And she asked me, when she died, if I would do this funeral vigil for her. And I told her that I would. And so I was in Ohio. I had some business that I was taking care of in Ohio. And I got a call that she had died. And it turned out that I was going to be back for the funeral anyway. So I was on the tarmac in Chicago, changing planes. We were, you know, boarding Southwest. And I'm sitting in the aisle seat because in case we crash, I want to be on the aisle. But of course I'm in my high heels. I always think about that when I'm on an airplane. Jamie, how are you going to run down that aisle in those high heels? But anyway, yeah, you have to look good. And so we're on the tarmac in Chicago, and this young man, he's about 21 years old, he says to me, is that seat taken? No, it's not taken. It's a middle seat. So he sits down. And most of the time, I don't like to talk on an airplane because I'm not comfortable flying, and so I want to pray. And so he started talking to me, you know, where are you going? Where do you live? And I said, oh, I'm going back to California. Oh, is that where you live? Yes, that's where I live. Where do you live? I live in Orange County. Oh, and the plane was landing in Orange County, of course. Oh, that's where you live. That's where I'm going. Oh, is that where you're going? Yes. He says, I'm going back for my grandma's funeral. And I said, you are? Where does your grandma live? He said, in Cyprus. I said, oh, and what's your grandma's name? And he tells me his grandma's name, and it was the gal that I was going to do the funeral vigil for, and I started to cry. And I said, I'm doing your grandma's funeral vigil. And he said, what? I mean, it was the most astounding thing. I said, okay, God, you are really showing off. I mean, you are really showing off, God. So anyway, that's how God works in my life. You know, that's my spiritual awakenings. It's those things that happen that, you know, it's those aha things. So I'm going to close here, but I always like to close. I want to tell you a little story about the World Service Conference because it ties in with how I'm going to close. When I was elected delegate, Baba Han said to me, Jamie, I want you to remember one thing. He said, he called me up. He said, I want you to remember one thing. He said, you're not here. Okay, Bob. But most of the delegates, including Willie, said to me, past delegates said to me, it's going to change your life. It has changed my life, but it changed my heart. I have to tell you that there isn't a day go by that I'm not challenged to work spiritual principles and to be honest and to be responsible and to be accountable and to be respectful. And it's also taught me about that minority voice. It's taught me about that minority voice that I'm not afraid of it anymore because I was always afraid of that minority voice. It's also taught me about defending my right to be right. See, I got to these rooms and my fists were clenched and I had to defend my right to be right. And it's taught me not to do that. It really, really has. It's about that minority voice and not being afraid of it. But I have to tell you, when I walked into my first World Service Conference, I felt like that newcomer again. I was in awe. I looked around the room and I said, the area has made a mistake. I really thought that. It was like, I looked around the room and it was like that everybody was more complex. You know, there were doctors, PhDs, you know, there were all these people that had all these degrees. And there I was. And I felt like I didn't belong again. You know, the outsides were okay. I was dressed okay, but the insides felt like that. I didn't belong here. I wasn't enough. But then, at some point, you know, I finally lost my fear of criticism, and I went to the microphone, and I shared. You know, I contributed to the largest group conscience in the Worldwide Fellowship of Al-Anon, and I felt like an equal. I knew that God was working in my life. I felt my higher power, and I felt and so with that, our Al-Anon literature, and my favorite book is Many Voices, One Journey. And on page 263, it says, Lois W., and I want you to know something. Lois W. is a co-founder of Al-Anon. 94 or something. And she was about my size, maybe a little bigger. Co-founder of Al-Anon. And so you are co-founder. There was a deafening applause as she stood up to speak. Applause for her when she completed. You all right? And like that, did I do all right?